A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
When I discovered Darius' story, I stayed up till 4 in the morning that night making sure there was no other documentary. And when I was certain that there wasn't, I just knew in that moment that I would spend the next 3 years of my life telling that story.
When aspiring documentarian Adam Irving approached Darius McCollum about telling his story, he learned he was the 27th person who hoped to make a film about this obsessed New Yorker who just couldn't stop stealing trains and buses despite repeated incarcerations. Irving tells us how he succeeded where others failed, and how his documentary, Off the Rails, turned into something more than the simple caper movie he originally intended to make. But first on the News Banter, will the feds let AT&T buy Time Warner? And Sumner Redstone wants a refund. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
You know, last week we had just been hearing rumors of a potential AT&T bid for Time Warner. And very quickly after we had that conversation, AT&T not only bid for Time Warner, but Time Warner agreed to accept the offer. It's a very rich offer. It's better than the one that Rupert Murdoch floated a couple years ago. It is a huge mega deal. It's very vertical, meaning we're not looking at a situation where one studio or television network acquires something very similar. You know, AT&T is broadband and wireless, and Time Warner is content, mostly. So the big question now, first of all, is whether the federal government will say, let's go ahead and approve this thing, or whether there's going to be noise just because of the sheer size of the company that would result.
Right. And that's the first question. And from what the people that I've talked to, some say it's a 50-50 chance with significant concessions made by AT&T to get this deal done. Some say, no way, Jose. This is a situation, you know, where the regulators learned their lesson on the Comcast-NBCUniversal merger, where Comcast promised to do all kinds of things to promote diverse voices and to alleviate some of the concerns of consolidation, and never did those things, and they won't be burned twice. It remains to be seen. It will be a long process, a year-long process. But what's interesting here is the reaction in Hollywood to this deal is not as much of a negative as I might have anticipated, and that's because of what you just said. There aren't that many redundancies when you put these two companies together. I mean, obviously, at the very top, in terms of, you know, leadership and corporate functions, things like that. But the creative industries are largely unique in this deal. Time Warner has these amazing properties in HBO, Warner Brothers, Turner Networks, all of these things that AT&T doesn't have. So it's not like the Fox situation where if you had combined 21st Century Fox and Time Warner, there would have been two movie studios and multiple networks and all of these other things that likely would have resulted in a reduction in force and a reduction in the number of voices out there.
And how many people would be buying in this market? You know, the more buyers, the better. Also, the fact, I think, that was we've reported Peter Chernin, who used to be the number two guy at Fox under Rupert Murdoch and when it was News Corp, and who was, you know, an investor. He's been in partnership with AT&T on certain things. He could be playing a big role in all of this. And I think people feel like Peter Chernin is a seasoned industry veteran. And whatever there have been issues with management, there's been a feeling that Jeff Bukas has been running this company to sell it more than running it to make it great. And I think there's some feeling like maybe a change in direction or some experienced hand at the top would be a good thing.
Right. And then you put together that with all of the distribution opportunities that a company like AT&T brings to the table. And, you know, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but at least there would be a clear plan forward on how to capitalize on distribution plus content.
Now, I will say that this deal, the mere thought of this deal, I'm going to guess, is going to turbocharge this potential deal that we've talked about before, which would bring Viacom, the parent company of MTV Networks and Paramount Pictures together with CBS. They were together once. They were split apart. Most people I've talked to feel like the thought of having Viacom adrift as a troubled company without bulking up by reuniting with CBS, with Les Moonves at the top, talking about seasoned, experienced executives who people feel is almost irrational hope for that he can just change everything. That deal seems to go forward because once consolidation starts, you know, dominoes fall.
Right. The word mega merger mania, if that's a word or phrase, has been used. And I think that, you know, it started already this year with the Lionsgate Stars merger, which is heading towards the finish line. The feeling that you need to be big, I think, is what's dominating now. You don't want to be left out. You're either a buyer or a seller. And there are a lot of these companies that, you know, the fear of getting gobbled up might get them into talks when they might not otherwise be in talks.
And on a side note, Sumner Redstone, the 93-year-old frail mogul, very frail, speaks now, we're told, thanks to court activity that I'm about to describe, speaks now through an electronic voice. Sumner Redstone, supposedly or possibly in concert with his daughter, Shari, is going after Manuela Hertzer and Sidney Holland, the two women who for some years were very much part of Sumner Redstone's life. One of them was his girlfriend. That was Sidney Holland. Manuela Hertzer was a former girlfriend and a sort of companion. The allegation now in this lawsuit is that they manipulated and abused Sumner Redstone, and the attempt here is to recoup $150 million in gifts that he had given to the two of them. You know, this is something that people wondered about for years, what was really going on inside that mansion, and the allegation now is pretty much that these two women mistreated Sumner Redstone and stripped him of a lot of money.
Yeah, it's an interesting argument because, you know, as we know from what's just gone on with the Viacom saga, the position that Shari Redstone and a lot of the people trying to, you know, take control of the company has been is that Sumner Redstone is lucid and alert and has conversations with them about the future of the company, and ejecting Philippe Domon, the CEO of the company, from Viacom and replacing the board members. All of that was done in sound mind by Sumner Redstone. And now we have in a litigation filing Sumner Redstone claiming that he's been the victim of elder abuse and manipulated by these two women for years, and they've taken advantage of him in a frail state. So it's kind of a question, and Sidney Holland has said this in a statement. It's which one is it? Is he the, you know, domineering presence that he's always been, or is he this frail person who can no longer make decisions for himself? And I think that's going to be the subject of this litigation going forward.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised they're doing this. There was this whole lot of litigation of Sumner Redstone and or his daughter, Shari, struggling to get control of Viacom and get rid of Philippe Domon and get rid of these two women. And now there's still more litigation. And of course, you know, the idea that these women are going to want to give up the money is not too believable. So they're continuing to open the door to all kinds of, you know, unpleasantness in court. But
oh,
there
yeah.
you have
I mean,
it.
Think about what these girlfriends have seen and done and know, you know, spending all that time in the Sumner Redstone mansion. All of that could be spilled in open court.
Of course, there's been other already exposed all kinds of sexcapades and behavior. So maybe they figure how much worse could it get? I don't know. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. The new documentary, Off the Rails, tells the story of Darius McCollum, a 51-year-old New Yorker with a lifelong love for and encyclopedic knowledge of the area's transit system.
My name is Darius McCollum. Over the years, I have operated trains in the New York City subway system, Metro North, New Jersey Transit. And yet, I have never been an employee of any of these agencies.
McCollum, who was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, has never hurt anyone during his transit escapades. He even picks up and drops off passengers as scheduled. But his behavior has landed him in prison 32 times. That story captivated 34-year-old first-time filmmaker Adam Irving, a Canadian who several years ago began a PhD in film studies at the University of Texas. Before he finished, Irving decided academia wasn't for him. He moved to L.A., where at first he could only find work as a cameraman for reality shows.
There were moments when I was sitting on set of Brides of Beverly Hills, the TLC reality show, thinking, I can't believe I dropped out of my PhD program just a couple years away from being Dr. Adam Irving for this.
So you were doing the Brides of Beverly Hills. I'm just wondering how you came to enter by way of that.
I guess I was just looking for any work to get a foot in the door, and I found a posting online looking for something very specific, which was a Canadian citizen living in LA that owned a Sony EX1 camcorder. I'm guessing I'm the only person who responded to the ad, and that's why I got the job. And the reason was there was a Canadian production company that gets tax credits for hiring Canadians. Then rather than finding a Canadian in Canada and flying them in and putting them up in a hotel, they thought they'd find one who's already in LA living in a home that they didn't have to pay for.
That is quite a remarkable job posting and very typical of what I know of how reality shows are made.
Yeah, sure.
So then at some point, I'm not sure if this is a straight jump, you find out about Darius McCollum on the internet?
Yeah, I read his Wikipedia page when I was researching foamers. Foamer is a derogatory term for someone who is so obsessed with trains that they foam at the mouth when they see one.
And you were interested in foamers because?
Sounds pretty interesting.
You heard the word, I have never heard the word foamers.
I saw the term listed on a YouTube video that went viral of a guy filming a train going by, and the person filming it was jumping up and down and acting as though it was the greatest moment of his life. And I learned there's a subculture of train buffs that are really, really into trains. And through that research, I discovered Darius McCollum, who is the ultimate foamer because he has spent over 20 years in prison for his love of trains.
So did you find that you were the only guy who was interested in this particular person?
No. I found out I was the 27th filmmaker to approach Darius to do a documentary. And even before my documentary, there was an off-Broadway play called Boy Steals Train. And I contacted the writer and director of the play, Jude Domsky, to get to Darius.
How did you beat out 20? I mean, did the 27 all come and go?
They did for the most part. I really wanted to know why they all left and was afraid that I would just be lost in that group. But I realized it wasn't because Darius scared them off. It wasn't because they couldn't get his cooperation, which is what I assume, but just because of the difficulties of filmmaking without money. If you're an independent filmmaker and just decide to make a film and don't have $500,000, it's very unlikely you'd be able to finish your project unless you got a grant or, you know, a broadcaster on board. And I contacted some of the filmmakers and they said there was no foul play. They just, you know, life happened to them. One of them had a baby. One of them got married. One of them had to take care of a sick parent. One of them couldn't raise the money. A million different reasons. But I just knew none of that would happen to me and that there would not be a 28th filmmaker.
How did you know?
I'm very confident and I always finish what I start, except for my PhD.
Okay, yeah, so we have a little footnote there. So I assume that you, while you were shooting The Brides of Beverly Hills, you were looking for a project like something compelling and thinking doc, is that
Oh yeah. Fair? Yeah. I had no interest in spending the rest of my life chasing brides around a bridal gown store in Beverly Hills. And in fact, that's really why I moved to LA, why I left my PhD program, was to make documentaries. But I just couldn't find an idea that was really, really good that no one had already done before. And when I discovered Darius's story, I stayed up till 4 a.m. that night making sure there was no other documentary. And when I was certain that there wasn't, I just knew in that moment that I would spend the next 3 years of my life telling that story.
So you found your guy, and he seems receptive, I assume, because Darius loves attention.
He does. He thrives on it. He has quite the ego and will never turn down an opportunity to be in the newspaper or on television, etc.
Right. Do you approach him and get him on board and then try to find money?
No, I had the money already.
What?
And,
The Brides of Beverly Hills pays better than I thought.
No, part of it was having, you know, $30,000 in equipment from working on different shows, buying my own gear, and also doing a lot of corporate videos for nonprofit organizations and universities. So
that was like your sort of sideline of money making.
Yeah,
bread buttering.
That's how I could make a living and learn how to use all this equipment so that when I was ready to make the Darius McCollum story, I didn't have to go out and buy equipment. I didn't have to hire a DP or a producer or a director or an editor. I did all of that myself. So I didn't need as much money as a traditional documentary production would.
So let me get this straight. You're sitting there, you're doing your thing, you're making your corporate nonprofit videos, and you're doing The Brides, and you're doing all of that, and you're squirreling away money because you're thinking, I've got a plan, and the plan is I'm going to find my thing, and then I'm going to do my thing.
That's right. That was my dream. That was my goal, and it was just a question of finding that dream story.
I'm blown away by this. So how did you figure out how much you were going to have to spend? And was it a realistic number?
I looked at sample budgets and doubled them because I've learned that's something you have to do. And I tried to learn from filmmakers who made a lot of first-timer mistakes and not make them myself. And one of the biggest mistakes is all the budget eggs are put in the production basket rather than the promotional stuff. And I've learned almost all the things that matter are after you've made the film, your publicist, you know, going to festivals, getting your key art made, because that's what people pay attention to. This is all assuming you have a good film, of course.
Right. That's like a fundamental thing.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's just go through the process a little bit more step by step. So you went to, I assume you got the person who had written the play about him to approach him, or did you just approach Darius yourself?
No, I was afraid to approach Darius myself. I have never known an inmate. I wouldn't know the first thing about contacting one or dealing with one. And so I went to this playwright and I actually flew to New York, sat down with her, and I told her what I wanted to do. And she was pretty protective of Darius. She said there's a lot of filmmakers that have tried to get to him and promised him all kinds of things and then disappeared. So I want to make sure that you're serious. So I sat there for an hour proving to her how confident and serious I was.
What did you do?
I told her I had financing. I told her I had made short documentaries before for a nonprofit organization, so I wasn't just a student with an iPhone. And I told her that I'm a very reliable, responsible person, that I'm not like a hippy-dippy artist who bounces around from painting to music to film. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I just wanted to show her that I'm a man of my word, and I think she could just feel it in the tone of my voice.
So she then puts you in touch with Darius.
Yeah. Well, first she reaches out to him, butters him up, and she gave me his address.
He was out at that point. He was in the system.
Yeah, he was on the inside. So I exchanged over 100 letters with him over the course of 6 months. And our communication started off very formal because we didn't know each other well. And then slowly Darius would ask me more and more personal questions. Do you have a girlfriend? Do you like peanut butter? What's your favorite subway train in New York? And then I would ask him more and more personal questions, deeper things about why does he really love trains? Is it scary to be in an 8-foot cell? You know, those sorts of things. And by the end of the 6 months, I felt ready to meet him. So I flew to New York and had my first face-to-face encounter with Darius.
Now, you know, filming in prison is, as we know from other things we've talked about, that's hard.
Yeah, it was one of the hardest things I've done. Though I should say, once you have permission to film in prison, it's easier to get in because you're treated like a journalist and you kind of go in the back door. So you don't have to spend 4 hours getting strip searched and waiting in line with folks who are visiting inmates who many of them themselves are former inmates. So it's not exactly the most friendly crowd to hang out with when you're waiting to get access because they treat you like a threat. Because when you get to Rikers, there's no glass window. You can make contact with the inmates. So they want to make sure that you're not going to pass on anything. So you even have to take off your shoelaces and your belt. It's
right.
Quite something.
So aside from filming Darius, you got various other people, including his mother, a long-suffering woman, truly. I imagine the mother might have been a little bit leery.
Yeah. His mother just didn't trust me because there's so many reporters that call her almost every week. And she gives them an interview on the phone. And then the next day, there's some tabloid headline like Transit Kook Strikes Again. And Darius's mother doesn't like Darius to be portrayed as a kook. So I needed to convince her that I'm doing a documentary. It's a multi-year project that's nuanced, that will go into the reasons and causes for Darius's behavior and not just slap him with a label, put on a half a page story, and then move on.
Coming up after a short break, Adam Irving tells us who Darius McCollum wants to portray him in the feature film version of his story, a project in development as a vehicle for Julia Roberts to play McCollum's lawyer. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with filmmaker Adam Irving about his new documentary, Off the Rails, which opens in theaters November 4th. The film follows the life of Darius McCollum, a New Yorker with Asperger's syndrome who has spent years in prison due to an uncanny ability to impersonate transit authority workers and make off with buses and subway trains. McCollum is clearly intelligent, and he's never injured anyone. But the system seemingly has no solutions for this troubled, low-income repeat offender other than prison and more prison. Off the Rails features footage of Darius behind bars, as well as interviews with his lawyer, Sally Butler.
There's a possibility that I can definitely die in jail.
He's an individual that corrections doesn't know how to handle, doesn't want to handle, and doesn't have the money or the support to figure it out.
When Adam Irving set out to make a documentary about McCollum, he wasn't expecting to delve into these issues.
I would say I went through an arc of my own, an evolution as a filmmaker, in that I started off to make a quirky, sort of catch-me-if-you-can story about a really interesting criminal that you're kind of rooting for because he's duping people. And it wasn't until I really got deep in the story that I realized there's a lot more to it, that there's an opportunity for an advocacy film without doing it so on the nose as an advocacy film. Because at its core, it's a character-driven film that just happens to be a really good critique of the criminal justice system. And when I started testing early drafts of the film on audiences, it wasn't the fun, quirky angle that they responded to, but the, frankly, sad waste of a very talented, sweet person's life. A person who is very smart, nonviolent, never damaged any property, but has spent more than half his life in maximum security prison for doing something that people in New York who work for the MTA do every day and don't go to jail for.
And probably in some cases doing it better than professionals were doing the job. I mean, the guy really knows that system. I mean, did you worry at all that you were feeding his craving for attention by making a film about him?
I knew that I was doing it, but I didn't worry about it because I felt that the act of making the film and the results would far outweigh the harmful effects of giving him attention, encouraging him to do this again and again, because he's going to do it again and again anyway. So I might as well bring positive attention to his case so that he can get the help he needs to get out of this cycle.
Except you wonder if he ever can. I mean, I did. He seemed so addicted to this.
Yeah, I actually don't think he can on his own. He doesn't have the tools to help himself, but others can help him.
Well, so once you finish the film, there's no happy ending. He gets out for a minute, but he's not staying out. So you had to let it be what it was. And then what did you do? You had to get it. You tried to get into a bunch of film festivals, and you didn't have luck at Sundance or South by Southwest and Tribeca. So that must have been a moment of why?
Yeah, it was really discouraging. There were films, in my opinion, that did get into those festivals that I didn't think were as good. But I learned that festivals aren't just about taking the best films. They have to curate a program that has a diverse range of topics and characters. So I just tried to maintain a positive attitude. And then when I started getting into festivals, it just kind of snowballed. And I got into more and more. I started winning awards. And then I got a sales agent. And then I got 4 distribution deals that have now all gone through, and I'm getting good reviews, and now it's in a really good place.
So that had a better ending
absolutely
in some ways than the story it tells. What was the first yes that you got?
Full Frame and Hot Docs, which are both prestigious film festivals that specialize in documentaries. And those are both in April of this year. And once that happened, I could get reviews and press from that. And it all kind of went up from there.
Now, were you thinking in the beginning when you were saving your bride money,
yeah,
your reality TV money, were you thinking, maybe I'll have an Oscar campaign?
Yes.
My I love
goal,
that.
My goal was to be nominated for the Academy Award for Best Documentary. And of course, I knew that was an unrealistic goal, but it's still a possibility. I just really believe that if I executed this film well and it caught on with the right people, that there was a chance, that maybe there could be some Oscar buzz around it.
So is somebody going to help you with that, or are you going to have to figure it out yourself?
I have someone helping me. I have an awards publicist who specializes in creating awareness about my film.
But none of your distributors are ponying up and saying, we're going to help you with this.
Not at all.
not at all. Okay. Just to keep it real, just got to do it yourself.
Yeah. This is all coming out of my own pocket. And it's something I've learned that unless you're picked up by Netflix or maybe Amazon or CNN or HBO, no distributor is going to put any real money behind an awards campaign for a small documentary film.
Have you had those conversations with Netflix and Amazon? Or?
Well, they passed on the film.
Okay.
So they're not part of that equation anymore.
Right.
And the only way to compete with them is do what they do, which is to have an awards campaign. Otherwise, the system's rigged in a sense, you know, because...
Please don't say that.
How timely.
Yes. Okay. Another rigged system. But yeah, you have to do it for yourself. And do you come out okay? I mean, do you feel like, oh my God, I've dug a hole? Or do you feel like I planned for this and I'm good?
I feel I planned for this and I'm good. And I feel that there is more to getting the recognition and attention in an awards campaign than literally making the exact amount of money you spent on the campaign. So if in the end I haven't broken even or made much money, I feel that it's put me on the map as a documentary filmmaker, and that has much more value than getting an extra $100,000 from a distributor.
And so there was some talk about a scripted version of this with Julia Roberts playing the lawyer, Sally Butler. Is that a live thing? I'm not sure.
Yes, as far as I know, the story is happening. It's been greenlit and financed by Film Nation. And there's a director rumored to be on board, John Crowley, who directed Brooklyn. I don't know who's going to be playing Darius. The last I've heard from the folks behind the film, it's supposed to film this year and be released next year. But that's really all I know. And that film is going to be quite a big deal with Julia Roberts in it. And I think it can only help my film, and it can only help bring attention to Darius's case in a way that my film can't, just because of the scale of an independent documentary.
Sure, sure. And then is Darius getting paid not by you?
Well, I'm not personally paying him, but I have in my contract an agreement that makes sure that he's compensated in certain ways. But I imagine that will be peanuts compared to compensation he may receive for the Julia Roberts movie.
But if he's in prison, isn't there an attempt to invoke the Son of Sam law that would prevent him from profiting?
Yeah, it's not really related to him being in prison. It's really just that he committed a felony. And in the state of New York, with the Son of Sam law, one cannot earn money from plays, books, movies, etc., related to those crimes.
Right.
So yeah, whatever money is given to Darius, in theory, could be taken away by the state of New York. So perhaps Darius's lawyer will find creative ways to get him that compensation. Otherwise, that's going to be a whole other mess. And I think that will help get even more people behind him, because that also, I think, is an injustice, because Darius's crimes are victimless. So there's no reason not to let him profit from just telling his life story. It's not like he went and killed some people and then sold a book about his murders.
Right. Now, he didn't get any editorial control over the film.
No, he didn't. He really didn't ask for a lot other than sort of amusing things, like he sent me a playlist of some 80s rock songs he wanted in the movie.
Did he send you the money for the licensing fees?
No, I had to explain that it's about, minimum $10,000 per song. And he also put in a request for Forrest Whitaker to play him in the Hollywood version. And I don't know if they will take his request. Oh, sure. Not a bad suggestion. But I don't think it's up to Darius who plays him in the movie.
Right. Adam Irving is the director of the documentary Off the Rails. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Kat Yore and Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.